Well, welcome to a special edition of the EC podcast. I'm Tim Cutler and I'm in the passenger seat with Peter Delapenna. Can't even get his name right. He's driving me between Abu Dhabi and Dubai at pace. Peter, how are you?
I am best friends this week with Sheikh Zayed Road.
You know it very well. I've already had my life flash in front of my eyes two or three times. I'm 3 hours into the Emirates, but you've been here for the entire group stage. What are your thoughts at this stage?
Well, it's not been short of entertainment, at least in Dubai. The matches at the ICC Academy that I've been fortunate enough to cover is where all the action's been for most of the week. All the non-TV games have provided the bulk of the drama. And unfortunately, the majority of the games that were slated to be broadcast in the stadium in Abu Dhabi, the Zayed Cricket Stadium, they've mostly been duds. And then the two matches inside the stadium in Dubai, the two night matches anyway, the first two night matches have been fairly one-sided as well. So it's been a good week to be covering the non-TV games from my perspective, because I've been getting people tweeting at me and desperate for updates. Come on. Why haven't you tweeted again in 5 minutes?
Well, absolutely. As someone who's been corralling match reporters, there's only so much you can do from a scorecard and a pretty general blog. I think your coverage has been excellent, and really, well, as much as not watching the telecast, it takes you there. So, as always, above and beyond from you. Who's been your biggest surprise packets, person or teams, at this point of the event?
Well, not just me, I think for everybody, Papua New Guinea has really exceeded expectations. And to be fair, if you go back historically through their performances at the T20 World Cup qualifier, especially 2013 and 2015, they've always been in the playoffs, and they've been in great positions to clinch a spot at the World Cup without having done it. They've performed very well at these events, but in the ODI format, in the Cricket World Cup League 2, they've just been so dire. And sometimes people conflate the formats, that if they're horrendous, losing 8 straight in the ODI League, you'd say they're playing horrible cricket, they've got no shot to come into this tournament, and I'm certainly guilty of that. And yet, you talk to them, and they said before the tournament started, leaving Florida, one of the last interviews I did with Joe Dawes, and I think from talking outside of all too, they both said they were very much looking forward to this event because they feel so much more comfortable playing T20 cricket as opposed to 50-over cricket, because that's the bulk of the cricket they do play at home in Papua New Guinea. And you can stand there and shake your head and nod politely, while in the back of your mind you're rolling your eyes thinking, like, come on, you guys, winning is a habit. You're not winning games. How do you realistically expect to turn around form when you're not playing T20 international cricket? Yeah, you might be playing cricket at home that's T20 level, but you're not playing T20 internationals. So you don't have the form, whether it's T20Is or ODIs, to back up that confidence. But yet, they show up here, and it's incredible. And the one thing that stood out about them, above all the other teams, yes, their fielding is always head and shoulders above most associates, but the fitness. In these conditions, everybody's been suffering. Kyle Kutzer had to miss an entire fielding innings, and then he missed the entire next match because of dehydration. Fred Clausen from the Netherlands has had to miss some games with dehydration because of an episode he had at a training session. He had 2 days off, and the Netherlands had 2 days off. And then they come out for the next match after he had performed very well in the first two matches, and he's not in the 11. They said, oh, he's dehydrated. And I said, what do you mean he's dehydrated? You guys just had 2 matches off. Said, no, it was a training session. It was just so hot at training. He was going through a spell, and they didn't feel comfortable playing him in the starting lineup after whatever happened at training. And yet, Papua New Guinea, they're lapping people, like, between the wickets, and just the speed in the field, speed between the wickets. You would never know that they're being put under the same conditions as everybody else at this tournament, because they are thriving in this heat, whereas everybody else, especially the European teams, are really struggling at times with the conditions. And that, to me, is what has stood out more than anything else. Their fitness levels are through the charts, and they are winning a psychological battle on that front too, because when you're the opposition and you see these guys lightning between the wickets in 95 degree Fahrenheit heat and they're showing no ill effects whatsoever, you're like, good God, what is it going to take to stop these guys? And that's why they're at the top of the group at the moment and on track possibly to clinch the outright World Cup berth if they can win the group.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's hard not to conflate their performances across formats, because the last time we saw them in a T20 World Cup qualifier was in 2015. That's a long time in emerging cricket. And they missed out there. They had the qualifier when they had to play against Afghanistan after Hong Kong had beat them in the crossover. And I think it was Hong Kong that beat them in 2013 as well, wasn't it, to go into the Bangladesh 2014 event. That was back when it was a biennial event, because there's been so much cricket that they've played, but it's basically all been 50-over cricket. And although they came fourth in the World Cricket League Championship, since then they haven't played well at all. I think they've done well to compartmentalise there and really focus, because I think we talk about them a lot as being a team of all-rounders, and I think that's been typified in one of these games where they actually bowled 9 different bowlers, didn't they? I think Tony Ura was the only, and the wicketkeeper, Dariga, were the only two not to bowl. I think that's amazing. It was in the game beforehand, they had 8 bowlers. I was like, well, why hasn't Siaka bowled? You know, he's been in a big bash squad environment as a leg spinning all rounder, and there he is batting 3 and not bowling. I think it's great. I'm really happy for them to see what they've put actually onto the field, because they've lost 8 one-day internationals on the trot. I guess it just shows the type of attitude and the type of people that we're dealing with, that they're able to come through and just put their best foot forward onto the field. But on the flip side, you mentioned Scotland losing their skipper for at least one game. Does this reflect back to their prep, i.e. going to South Africa rather than coming to the Middle East? Or is it just inherent, do you think, in those European players that they're just not, they just don't have that sort of almost long-term muscle body memory to deal with this type of heat?
I think the decision to go to South Africa has been overplayed in some areas. I don't think that that's the overarching reason why they've looked average at times in this event. I think part of it has to do with just the fact that there's more parity at this event. The teams are a lot more competitive, and I know it's a cliche, but yes, T20 cricket narrows the disparity between teams. You can win a match with relying on 2 or 3 key guys instead of in a 50-over game where you really need to have a lot more depth. And that's one area where Scotland has been so successful in, whether it's the World Cricket League Championship or now in the early stages of Cricket World Cup League 2, their depth, especially in 50-over cricket, is much stronger than most other teams, where, especially in pace bowling depth, if they get a player who goes down or is unavailable, like Rory Smith, for example, has been dealing with, I guess, a chest injury or side injury, recurring injury ever since the Tour of Oman. Adrian Neal missed some time. Chris Soule has gone off to Australia for his personal work-life reasons, and yet they've got Safian Sharif, they've got Allie Evans, Josh Davey, who's been focusing more on county commitments in recent years. Now he's back in this tournament. So the depth is there, and that helps them a lot in 50-over cricket. But in T20s, when they come up against a side like Singapore, Singapore might not be nearly as competitive if they were to come up against Scotland in a 50-over match. But all you need is one Tim David to beat you in a T20 match. And he did it more with his fielding than his batting or bowling in that match. But Seldar, Vijay Kumar, their other main strike weapon with the ball. You can win a match with just two or three key players in T20 cricket. You can get away with it. And Bermuda arguably did the same thing to USA. They leaned heavily on Delray Rollins. You take away Delray Rollins from the Bermuda team in the qualifier and the regional final in August, and there's a 99% chance USA walks through that round of qualifying and they'll be here instead of Bermuda. But Delray Rollins comes back from Sussex and he's a difference maker, and you get that in T20 cricket. So I think it's more of the fact that, come back to the original question, you're coming up against teams who they just need one dynamic impact player in T20 cricket that can make a world of difference, and that lack of depth becomes less of an issue in an event like this.
We are racing from Group B over to Group A. We've just seen Ireland make light work, if it's probably putting it lightly, of Nigeria. They chased down Nigeria's 66 for 9 in 6.1 overs. So that puts them ahead of Oman on net run rate, meaning that from the last three matches in Group B, when Oman play Jersey, UAE play Canada, and Hong Kong play Nigeria, basically Oman need to beat Jersey to guarantee first spot. If they don't, Ireland are in the box seat. What do you think is going to happen across those three games? Give us your prediction.
Well, Oman would have to do something spectacularly awful.
We've seen this before, though. Although it wasn't such a crucial game. Well, in Namibia, we did see them dirty the proverbial bed, didn't we, in the last game?
But
which got PNG ODI status.
But you have to remember, they had already clinched ODI status going into that game, and they had the captain was injured. You're playing five games in 7 days on what would be the last day of the round robin stage. 50 over games in 7 days. So the physical toll, if you've already clinched, you don't want to wreck a guy's career by stretching him for that last match. So you can understand it. In this situation, they're coming off a rest day against Jersey, and there is still something for them to play for. So Ireland's put the pressure back on them to ensure that you guys got to win against Jersey to win the group. I cannot see Oman flopping in that situation.
Okay, so that leaves it with Oman, Ireland, Canada, UAE. Geez, that's a bit of a coin toss at the moment, isn't it?
3 or 4 days ago, I would have said Canada would walk that game. And then some funny things have happened. They slip up against Hong Kong, and they got absolutely bulldozed by Oman, talking about Canada, in their last match. And after starting 3-0, when you come out of a match like that, it can really dent your confidence. UAE, what's been impressive about them is their resiliency over the last couple weeks. Experiencing what they have been with all of the anti-corruption suspensions that have occurred and another player basically disappearing in the middle of the night, going back to Pakistan, even though he wasn't the target of the investigation, that might be enough to rattle a lot of teams and to shake their own confidence. And yet, they're still in contention. Three wins on home soil, in home conditions, and you can't write them off because of that. if on paper, if you'd say, oh, a slew of players have been suspended for allegations of corruption and everything associated with that, you'd say, oh, well, this team's got no chance. They're going to go probably lose at least five of the games. They might maybe beat Nigeria, but otherwise they're going to get hammered by the other teams because it's killed their focus and their chemistry and all that. But here we are with basically a one-match shootout. If they win, they're in the playoffs. So the job that Dougie Brown has done to keep them together, and Ahmed Raza too, he's gained a lot of respect, I think, from a lot of the teams here and people covering this tournament for the way he's handled things, stepping in to lead the team in the absence of Naveed under those circumstances to keep the team together. And they've shown a lot of fight on the field. They've shown a lot of energy. They've shown a lot of spirit. They're rallying around each other. I think I would still tend to lean on Canada just because I think they've got a little bit more depth with the suspensions that have affected UAE. But a big thing that will come to consideration is Saad Bin Zafar. He didn't play against Oman. He's dealing with a chest injury that's hampering his ability to bat. And he can bowl. And it's whether Canada wants to take the risk. Do they feel that they need to bat as deep as Saad at 8, 9, 10 to be concerned about needing him to score runs in a match situation? Or are they comfortable enough there that the top order is going to provide enough runs and they just need him to bowl and field and that'll be enough? If he plays, I'd give Canada the edge, but we've seen some funny things happen.
Ahmed Raza, you talk about captaining or coming into captain a side in tumultuous circumstances. Tim Payne came into captain the Australian Test team after Sandpaper Gate, but really that is nothing as to what Ahmed Raza, who has not been a regular fixture in the side either, has he, for the last couple of years. He last captained the team in 2015 in that series, I think, when Mark Chapman scored his ODI century on debut, and he wasn't captain for much longer after that, was he? And hasn't necessarily always been there, but to have done what he's, well, he seems to just have a calm about him when he's on the field and be smiling and relaxed, which goes a long way to show where a team's at.
Well, also he's somebody who leads by example, especially in the field. He's one of their top fielders, and he always has been. He's somebody who's come up through UAE under 19 system. He's essentially born and raised in the UAE in Sharjah, and he's been somebody who, for as tall as he is, he's a left-arm spinner, but he's a tall left-arm spinner. He has a surprising amount of athleticism for somebody at his height.
I know how he feels. And pay no attention to the large man next to you. Within him, there is a skinny former, you know.
If in this kind of situation, how does he galvanize his teammates?
Yeah.
Through fielding is the first opportunity to do that. And when you have somebody who is throwing his body around, sliding, diving, you know, for somebody over 6 feet to get down as with the amount of agility that he does to dive and slide and run around and do things in the circle, and then that's only going to make sure everybody else is pulling their weight wherever they're fielding in their respective positions on the field. So that goes a long way. And yeah, a lot of credit goes to him for everything he's doing to keep the team together and give him a chance to continue on in the qualification journey.
There's also a key man that we haven't mentioned yet, which is Rohan Mustafa. You know, he, with the bat, with the ball, in the field, in that inner ring.
You better mention him.
Yeah.
He won't let you forget it if you don't. Oh,
dearie me. It's all right, we'll get a chance. You know, I've only just arrived, okay? Oh, look, if I get a chance to go to one of his press conferences, I'll make sure I ask him about himself. We've talked about his haircut on the pod before, so we don't need to talk about that again. But I think he's got to be one of the first guys right on your team sheet from this competition as to who you'd have to have in your team. He's probably someone that maybe has a bit of not anger, but a bit of something about him that may not be that pleasant to play against. But he's that guy that you want on your team, isn't he?
He's a chippy character. He's somebody who, if I'm making a comparison to...
Not going to talk about college football.
In American... No, I was going to go in a different... NHL. I was going to go for NHL.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Ice hockey.
Well, close, though.
He would be like a Claude Lemieux type player.
For those of us, the majority, that have no idea what you're talking about, can you elucidate, please?
Claude Lemieux was a winger. He played many, many years for a number of teams, including Montreal Canadiens, New Jersey Devils, and Colorado Avalanche. And he was a multiple Stanley Cup winner at each of those destinations because he was one of these guys who you love him when he's on your team and you absolutely hate to play against on the other team.
Okay.
Because he was skilled. I think as the years went on, his scoring ability became obscured. He was a very gifted goal scorer, but he was somebody who was also a grinder, who was very chippy. He would do some things almost in a, I guess to make another comparison, almost in a Luis Suarez sense, where he would do kind of some bizarre things, very chippy things, to get under the skin of the opposition.
I feel like Bez should be here for this. As soon as we get into talking about soccer.
And
sorry, Bez. Sorry, you couldn't make it.
Whether that's, you know, using his stick to trip, you know, another skater, or to give a check from behind, which is illegal in ice hockey for those who aren't aware of the rules. But checking from behind, that's a penalty. But hey, if the ref's not looking, Claude Lemieux is going to use his stick and he's going to cross-check you from behind and maybe plow you into the boards and knock you out of a series if it's the playoffs. And there was a very famous incident, in fact, where he basically, I believe it was Chris Draper, the Detroit Red Wings, Chris Draper was about to go into his bench. I think it was a line change situation. He checked him from behind, basically almost mangled his face. It was a gruesome injury. He got away with it. And for the next 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 years, maybe even to this day, whenever the two teams, it was in the playoffs. And because it was the playoffs, you're always hesitant to retaliate in the playoffs because if a guy gets suspended as a result of retaliating by starting a fight, you don't want to lose that guy for the series. So you behave yourself as best as you possibly can. You bite your lip and you just keep playing. But then, boom, regular season. For how many years in a row, when Claude Lemieux was around, literally from the opening faceoff, there would be bench-clearing brawls with the teams fighting each other to get retribution for something Claude Lemieux did the season prior, the playoffs prior. And the point is, he's somebody who you see on the other team and you got him in the crosshairs and you're like, I can't stand this guy. I want to just...
That's Peter punching his open hand if you're not sure.
But if...
We don't have the camera set up.
But if he's on your team, you're like, yeah, that's my boy, Claude Lemieux. That's my boy, Rohan Mustafa. Yeah, you get him, Rohan. You keep needling him. You keep getting under his skin. Yeah. And he does that and he's effective and... He's been a difference maker for the UAE.
Absolutely. He's close to, at this stage, player of the tournament for me. Thereabouts with Norman Vanua. Just maybe if he'd snuck that game against Scotland, I think he might have been up there as well. But it's also Asad Vala at the top for PNG. So in all of that, and the lovely hockey reference, which I appreciate, my extended knowledge of ice hockey is the Three Mighty Ducks movies. So thank you for that. I appreciate it. I'm sure everyone listening around the emerging cricket world does as well. But with all of that, you haven't given us a prediction between UAE and Canada.
Canada.
Well, that was not quite as long-winded. Okay. So the big one in that conversation about that result is that if it's a big result either way, as in a large winning margin, that really brings Hong Kong into play, because that means that if they're able to defeat Nigeria by broad enough margin, that they could potentially catch whoever loses between the UN, UAE and Canada, assuming Oman beat Jersey. Can you see that happening?
Absolutely.
It would be a very Hong Kong thing to do.
The worst thing that could happen for Hong Kong is for the UAE-Canada match basically to go down to the final ball.
Yeah.
And it's... I think the only thing that is kind of to Hong Kong's disadvantage, if you will, is the fact that the UAE-Canada game is the very last match in group play. So whoever is, I guess, in danger of losing that UAE-Canada match at night, if they're creative enough in terms of stretching the match out to avoid taking a net run rate hit, it's still possible for them to lose and advance because they'll know how quickly or how wide a margin Hong Kong has beaten Nigeria earlier in the day, if we assume Hong Kong beats Nigeria.
And the other thing will be, potentially, if Oman has lost to Jersey, that also how hard they're going, but that'll make the Hong Kong result irrelevant in the end. But, geez, well, it's all going to come down to the last day. You almost get sick of saying it with these events. Yeah, all come, World Cricket League 2 Namibia, all coming down to the last day, all results possible.
And the weird thing about this is, in a World Cricket League situation, all the matches would be happening simultaneously.
Yeah.
So the net run rate permutations are just mind-blowing. Your head's spinning around in circles. The teams do have the advantage of being able to calculate before the match has started or before the chases started in their final match versus all the matches are happening at the same time. You literally cannot do the permutations because you saw it in Namibia. Mm-hmm.
Everything's happening at the same time.
Papua New Guinea looks like they were going to get bowled out for, I think, 90 or 100 at one stage. And 3 hours later, they're the ones who are bowling out Oman for under 100.
I think I actually called them as gone at one stage. I was 6 for 60?
I took a hell of a lot of crap from Lenny because I was on air doing the USA-Canada match with him on the online stream. And we looked at the score and we're like, oh, yeah. What a sad event for Papua New Guinea. Look at how far they've fallen. Losing ODI status, man. Things just keep going in the wrong direction for them. And Lenny was like, hey, don't write them off yet. The match isn't over. They've still got to lose the last 3 or 4 wickets. And then 3 hours later, I come back from my second stint, and Lenny's mocking me.
How does the line go? The news of my death has been grossly over. What is it?
Exaggerated.
Over-exaggerated, exactly. So that's Group B. So with your results there, you've got Oman, Ireland, UAE, Canada is sneaking in, basically. I think that's where we're going. Unless there's a real blowout in the UAE-Canada match, but say you're thinking that they'll be able to canoodle their way through. I'm not sure canoodling is the right word there, but it's going to stay in. This is a no-edit podcast as we drive here into a sandstorm.
And a Mark Root 66 sign.
A Mark Root 66 sign with nothing but sand around it. Move to Group A. Now we're trying to hot foot it over to catch the Bermuda Netherlands game. And then after that, we have Namibia Singapore. How do you see Group A rolling out?
Well, Netherlands have played fairly well. I think Papua New Guinea has been the standout team, but Netherlands not far behind. They would have to do something spectacularly awful to stuff up against Bermuda. And then it comes down to, essentially, they've got something to play for heading into that Scotland match. If they beat Bermuda as expected, then it could come down to a case of net run rate to decide that group. You could have Papua New Guinea and the Netherlands both gunning for the top spot on net run rate. And Netherlands is going to have to do it against a very tough opponent in Scotland. On the Singapore-Namibia front, Singapore has been affected by the suspension of Selador Vijay Kumar much, much more than Scotland has by the bowling suspension of Tom Sowell. Again, going back to that depth, Scotland has so many other options. You knock Tom Sowell out, well, Michael East can step in and bowl off spin. Even Callum McLeod can come in and bowl some overs if you need him to. You've got Mark Watt and Hamza Tahir, who, in my eyes, have been the two standout spinners of this tournament. And they're not necessarily in player of the tournament consideration. They're not on the graphics that you see on TV amongst the leading wicket takers lists because they've been sharing the wickets. You see Bernard Schultz of Namibia near the top of the wickets list because he's one of the reliable options that Namibia has, but Scotland has multiple options. So Tom Sowell's been knocked out with a suspect action, but Scotland's able to overcome that. Singapore has not been able to overcome that with Selador being KO'd, and they've lost three straight now. Namibia, on the other hand, after getting a couple of rough matchups to start the tournament against Netherlands and PNG, they're on fire right now. And if you look at the momentum swings that both teams are experiencing, Namibia reeling off three straight wins, and Singapore now three straight losses, minus their strike bowler, I would be stunned if Namibia somehow botches that situation. They should get past Singapore relatively easily. The only thing that's standing in their way is Tim David. Haven't really seen Tim David make a big, big score. And on TV,
he threatened last night or yesterday afternoon.
He's threatened a few times. He's gotten in a few times. He's gotten his eye on. He's looked good and then got out. But we saw Delroy Rollins on TV similarly against Scotland. Scotland, we're getting a little bit edgy at the halfway point of that chase because Bermuda were way ahead of Scotland's run rate. And Delroy Rollins was clobbering the ball everywhere. Scotland basically turned that chase around because for a two or three over stretch, Mark Watt and Hamza Tahir basically kept him off strike. And the partners for Rollins couldn't get singles to keep him in rhythm and choked the run rate at the opposite end. And then that sparked not just wicket to that end, but the wicket of Rollins.
If you can hear that beeping, that means we're going over 120 kilometers an hour.
We're in Dubai now, where the limit's 120, and these cars are fixed with sensors.
With PDP alarms.
To let you know if you're being naughty.
So not only are we trying to get there in time for the first delivery, but also the food that is waiting for us.
This is very, very important, especially for a fat guy like me. I've just discovered on Twitter.
Yeah, see, I took a selfie. Get over on Twitter and have a look, but I just arrived all excited, a bit like a schoolboy. Took a selfie of Peter and myself with Sheikh Zayed Cricket Stadium in the background, and two responses to that tweet were a few responses saying that you look nothing like the photo, your profile photo or that picture, and then two other enthusiastic fans from Nepal, no less, saying that you look fat. How do you respond to those accusations?
Too much Five Guys. Too much Nando's. Too much Five Guys. Too much KFC.
You keep the sponsors happy, though.
And, or potential sponsors. We gotta keep the options open for the emerging cricket endorsement pool.
Well, I remember you saying a rising tide floats all boats. And, you know, I've been thinking about that, actually. I'm close to putting that as a quote on my, you know, Twitter bio, which is, you know, obviously a really important thing in, you know, first world, you know, what do you put as your Twitter bio, unlike yours where you're just surprising people. Now you're surprising people with your portliness. So how do you see Group A finishing up?
Well, first, I got to address that.
I did allow the accused. Sorry, how do you respond?
The players have it easy. They get to play one match, and then they can go back to the hotel, they can go swim, they can go to the gym for another workout session. They can do other things just to pass the leisure time. If you're covering three matches in a day, you've got to squeeze in food on the drive along Sheikh Zayed Road.
And then these people ask you to do podcasts. Or you could have been eating.
Or you're at a match. You don't have time to go to the gym on tour. I haven't been to the gym more than twice this week, only on because of quick finishes to quick matches. But otherwise, I do try and maintain some sort of decent level of physical fitness on tour. To not,
obviously not enough
to not
for
fall,
yeah, fans.
To not fall into a state where I'm disturbing the image I have in the minds of some a few Nepalese supporters.
Well, I think we just need to get a photo shoot done. We're a lot more flattering because we did take that selfie very quickly. I was unlike some of the
shadows, the lighting, yeah, in the media box.
It was a lot.
Yeah, it was
the light was all behind
the wrong
this.
Direction exactly.
So there we were go. Flushed. So, back to us talking about cricket rather than the pounds. Group A. He's shrugging for the benefit of the tape. Peter Del Pinna is shrugging. This is the first time I've seen him not sure of an answer.
I'm trying to loosen my body up here. I'm getting stiff here with the first 40 minutes of the drive here coming down the home stretch. Group A. I like Papua New Guinea to top the group. I don't see how they will goof up against Kenya. And I like Namibia to advance at 4-2 as well. Netherlands are going to advance. And Scotland, to me, look like the team that are going to sneak in through the back door. After coming in arguably as favorites in their group, leading in as the co-defending champions, they've not looked sharp. I know they looked like $1 million on TV against Bermuda because Bermuda just doesn't have the depth beyond Delray Rollins and Bongi Leverock to compete with a team as strong as Scotland. But as sharp as they looked on TV, for all the games that weren't on TV, they did not look sharp at all. And they're coming up against a much more competitive Netherlands team who arguably has the best pace bowling unit in this tournament. When Fred Clawson went down, you've still got Paul van Meekeren. You've still got Brandon Glover, who's bowled fairly well. Tim Vanderkoekten, who looks like the greatest cricketer of all time. Ever since his...
Ever since
his child was born in the middle of the tour. Yes.
Okay, there you go.
And he watched it apparently over Facebook.
Over Facebook.
Facebook Live.
There are other mediums I'd probably choose to use rather than social media. There were video calling apps.
I'm assuming the setting was set to private for this one.
There's a little bit to unpack there. Unless you're saying that to other audience. There were other family that couldn't be there that they wanted there to be.
Potentially.
And the question also begs, where was the camera set up?
It's 2019.
Was it from the bowler's end or was it from behind the keeper?
2019.
I was present for the birth of my daughter Zara, and I'm just intrigued as to where do you set up a tripod? You're a man with a tripod; you should know these things.
I was very disappointed as somebody who prides himself in trying to get as many photos as possible on a cricket field. I didn't have anybody there to even take a photo of me with my wife and our daughter when we had our firstborn. Everybody kept asking me in my family. After Namorita was born,
did you live tweet it?
I did not live tweet it.
I was joking.
But the question I got was, where is the picture of you in the hospital scrubs holding the baby? It's like no nurse offered, nobody on the staff offered. And I was
when you're the man that does everything. Who's left to do it when you're not doing it?
Yeah, I was so overwhelmed with the moment and happy and nobody. Yeah, kind of. Tick that box to say, hey, Dad, do you want a photo? And it wasn't until, that night or the next morning that somebody came in, and I think it was one of my wife's sister-in-law, who was like, oh, yeah, you don't have a photo? We'll sort that out. And then it gave me time to put on one of my Hawaiian shirts.
No, I can't know. You're in you're in a Hawaiian shirt.
Have you not seen my WhatsApp display pic?
I had seen on all your phone numbers, yes?
Do you
stalk your profile photos? Is that what you're saying?
Do you not? Have you never noticed in all the messages we exchanged that I've got a Hawaiian shirt on in the delivery ward?
Yes, I have. Yes,
yeah, so I have it. There you go.
Another segue into...
It was a wonderful occasion. I had to celebrate. I had to show meters, how joyous and festive it was with Hawaiian spirit, Tim.
Okay. I get the feeling we're getting towards the back end of our journey now with the number of suggested route redirections. So I think we will end it there. You've made your predictions for the last couple of games here. So
continue
we'll
continue on D57 for 4 kilometres.
We've got another 10 or 12 minutes.
Well, I'm a little bit concerned that we're going to be having instructions yelled at us, but you apparently know the way. Why have you still got
I'm not flustered because I've almost got this down by heart. Okay. I, again, like I said, Shakeside Road.
Okay.
Best pals.
But you've still got it on. Is it a safety blanket?
This is just a reflexive habit, I suppose.
Yeah. So we've gone from doing 120 to now doing 60.
Well, this is just the bypass road.
Okay.
So we've gotten off Shakeside. Now because for people who aren't familiar with the Dubai geography, the Dubai Stadium is quite a ways inland. The main stretch of road, Shakeside Road, essentially hugs the coast, and that's where the metro line is, hugs the Gulf. Whereas the stadium is quite a distance into the desert, and so you need to go on this bypass road that'll reconnect you from Shakeside Road to Route 311. 311 is the next portion of the road.
Of everyone's visit with us. So I was trying to come up with a name. There's a singing in cars at the moment. What's there's riding in cars with boys. That's probably as close. Riding in cars, talking cricket in Dubai. I don't know. We'll have to come up with a title. So for those of you that have got this far in the podcast, please tweet us with your suggested title for... these conversationals, shall we call them? You got any other suggestions?
Riding in cars with psychotic drivers riding straight up your tail in Dubai. This is the other part of the podcast that isn't visible. Some of the most maniacal drivers I've ever come across anywhere in the world are in Dubai and Abu Dhabi.
Maniacal. What does that mean?
Well, they're just...
I've never heard that word before.
I feel like I'm in a horror movie with the 4x4 behind me flashing lights trying to run me off the road every so often here. And as somebody who grew up in northern New Jersey, who's very experienced driving in New York City where the drivers can be very aggressive, this is like New York City driving on steroids.
Wow. I always laugh about Brisbane drivers where I live now.
It's 600 metres, take a slip road to Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Road.
For some reason, when it rains, they seem to drive faster and have the gaps smaller. So ever since I've been back, we don't have a car. It's been 6 months I've been driven. I think after 6 years in Hong Kong and not driving, I don't have the urge to be Uber and whatnot.
Take the slip road to Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Road, then keep right at the fork.
I think it's actually added years to my life just because I don't have this pent-up stress. Even being seen next to you, I have this eerie calm. I'm just like, oh yeah, I've almost given up on the feeling. For a guy who loves his cars too. But
keep right at the fork.
As we approach Dubai International Stadium, I'll try and get this up as soon as possible. So hopefully while you're sitting there watching Bermuda against the Netherlands live on TV, it's great to see three games telecast today. Of course, Ireland just trounced Nigeria, who was still smiling. There's still hopefully a lot more to see of Nigeria in the years to come. So we've got two more games to go. Hopefully you'll be watching this, listening to this as you watch. But Peter, thank you for joining me. Well, thank you for driving me, for picking me up from the airport like a good friend.
We've got this gorgeous view now.
We've got this gorgeous view of
the skyscrapers that make up Dubai Marina.
And this isn't going to help the people listening to the podcast, though.
Basically got two gigantic chunks of skyscrapers in Dubai. You've got the main area, which is where kind of the Burj Khalifa is, closer to downtown, which is probably about 10 or 15 miles east of the stadium. And then there's like nothing but desert. for a good 10-15 mile stretch, and then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, it's like you've got a New York City Manhattan skyline set of more skyscrapers, which makes up kind of the Dubai Marina area. And at night, now it looks like
we should probably check out that marina in the night. And sounds like the place to be.
In the daytime, when we're having the sandstorm right now, it just looks like But at night, it's absolutely gorgeous, and yeah, it is a wonderful place to check out at night. Because you know why, Tim?
Why, Peter?
Because they've got a Five Guys at Dubai Marina.
And with that, I think it is best we bid everyone adieu. Thank you very much, Peter. And thank you for listening. Keep up with all of our coverage of the men's T20 World Cup qualifier from the UAE as we get towards the end of the group stage at Emerging Cricket Everywhere. People are social and also antisocial online at emergingcricket.com. I'm Tim Cutler here with Peter Della Penna, and enjoy the rest of your day wherever you are around the emerging cricket world. And sorry, Daniel Beswick, I'm stealing your lines. Goodbye, everybody. Yeah.